For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you very much. It's always an honor to give a talk here. It's also always slightly intimidating. I listen to a lot of the talks on podcasts and wander around, and it's weird to think that things that I say might circulate well after. So I have a handout today. I'll pass a few of these around. Maybe they can go around both directions. Hang on to one for myself. So what I wanted to talk about today was to talk about the death of Jacqueline Kyle Makin. I am giving you a photo, one of her family's photos, a 7-year-old Kekchi Maya girl who died while in custody of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection on December 8th, 2018. I want to talk about how that's connected to a series of other events that happen in Guatemala that have to do with U.S. policies, and also how this is connected to our own ancient twisted karma, right? Let me offer a couple disclaimers before I start. First, why this talk? This is not a usual Dharma talk. You're new to Ancient Dragon, usually the Dharma talks have to do with Buddhist teachings, often with the teachings of Ehe Dogen, who was the founder of Soto Zen. My talk instead is going to examine the deeper historical context of the current humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Why? Well, on Saturday, July 13th, this coming Saturday, there's going to be a rally at Daly Plaza, a rally called To Take Action to End Criminalization, Detention, and Deportations. And several members of our Sangha and other Buddhist organizations in the Chicago area are going to participate in this rally. And it seemed an opportune moment. I'm an anthropologist who specializes in Latin America, although mainly in Brazil. And I've taught about migration and U.S. Policies towards immigrants and also towards Central America for a very long time. I visited El Salvador and Guatemala several times, fairly recently with students. And I was previously a researcher with Human Rights Watch. I started working there in the late 80s through the early 90s, a time that was when the wars in El Salvador and Guatemala were winding down, but also perhaps because of that, a time of sort of peak violence. So I've been following these issues for quite a while, and it seemed like an opportune moment for me to share some of that knowledge with you. So the disclaimers, as I said, this isn't a regular Dharma talk. I suppose the Buddhist components will be at the margins or perhaps in the background or perhaps something for us to think about and talk about in question and answer period. I think it does point to a big ongoing debate, particularly in Western Buddhism, but I think one in contemporary Buddhism. And that is, what is an appropriate Buddhist response or appropriate Buddhist responses to our current political problems? Can we think of our ancient twisted karma as collective karma, as collective situations, conditions of greed, hatred, and delusion? How can we identify and think about them? How can we act, perhaps, to minimize them? The second disclaimer, this is a complicated issue. I'm not an immigration attorney. Immigration law is complicated, I think, even for lawyers. I don't know everything, so please excuse me if I skip over things that you're more knowledgeable about. Please pitch in, let me know. If things are unclear, please let me know. And finally, I'm approaching this as is unavoidable from my own Dharma position. as I said, I've been thinking about paying attention to reading about visiting Latin America and Central America for quite a long time in various different capacities. I think my response is also shaped by a Buddhist ethic of loving kindness that insists that we offer care and kindness to everyone, to all living beings without distinction. I think it's informed by a Buddhist epistemology that insists that these conventional distinctions that we use, here, there, us, them, are important, valid distinctions. It allows us to think logically, to make certain sorts of arguments, but are also, in a sense, delusions or illusions. In particular, they tend to misrepresent things as separate when they're interconnected. And so I think it's informed by a Buddhist sense of trying to understand interconnections, trying to understand interrelationships. So let me talk about Jacqueline's story. Jacqueline was the second child to die in detention in recent times. Unfortunately, not the last. Probably countless other children have died crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, although not necessarily in custody of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Service. There's been a large number of deaths, especially since border fortification started in the 1990s, 1996, 1997. Deaths in the desert were probably uncountable ones. So Jacqueline's story is just one story. Jacqueline's life and death and the reasons that led her to leave, her and her father to leave their home village are unique, just as every migrant story is unique. Just every person's story is unique. But I think it also helps us understand a larger pattern, a larger context, and some shifts and continuities in that larger context. So let me step back a little bit and offer you the big picture. It's probably a big picture that you are aware of if you've been paying attention to the news lately, but it's probably worth reminding us of this bigger picture so that I can situate Jacqueline and her home village of Guatemala within the bigger picture. First, despite the current humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, it's worth pointing out that the number of border crossers is dramatically down since the mid to late 1990s and early 2000s. In particular, the number of people crossing from Mexico is dramatically down. Nobody really knows why. It's possible that the U.S. recession in 2008 had an effect on this. The recession hit construction industries, service industries that employ a lot of people who cross the border without authorization. It's possible that the Mexican economy improved. The Mexican economy entered into a pretty serious economic crisis in the 1980s. Especially Mexico's rural economy was devastated by the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994. It's possible that Mexico's economy has rebounded. It's possible that border fortification that started, as I mentioned, in 1996 under the Clinton administration has made crossing the border more expensive and more difficult. And so people who would cross back and forth have simply decided to stay in the United States mostly. So the number of Mexicans crossing the border is down. Increasingly, border crossers are coming from three countries in Central America, the so-called Northern Triangle countries of Central America, Guatemala, that Jacqueline and her father came from, and Honduras and El Salvador. There's actually been an even bigger increase in the last 5 years or so in unauthorized immigration from Asia. So the nature of immigrants, where they're coming from, has changed pretty dramatically. There's been a shift in who is targeted for deportation. So starting around 2015, the Obama administration's Department of Justice encouraged Immigrations and Customs Enforcement to prioritize the apprehension of people who had outstanding criminal warrants. There's lots of problems with this. This category of criminal was often defined very broadly, very loosely. The current administration has shifted this and broadened dramatically who it is targeting for deportation. So a lot more people with no criminal records, besides possibly crossing the border without authorization, are being targeted for deportation. The current administration faces a bit of a problem in that the Obama administration deported more unauthorized immigrants than any other presidential immigration ever. The Trump administration wants to deport even more, so it's a challenge to do this. So in addition to expanding the number of people who are targeted by ICE, it's also expanded immigration and customs enforcement activities. The number of people who are targeted for removal who are not caught crossing the border has expanded dramatically. So the shift of emphasis has been from the border to increase ICE deportations in the so-called interior. This means that those who are targeted for deportation are more likely to have lived here in the United States for a lot longer. We're hearing a lot about the contemporary problem of families and unaccompanied minors crossing the border. Is this new? We don't really know. There was a big wave of unaccompanied minors, people under the age of 18, who were showing up at the border in 2014 during the Obama administration. A lot of families, too. These numbers only have been tracked recently. It's very likely that there were a large number of unaccompanied minors and families crossing the border in the 1980s. We'll talk a little bit more about this. But those numbers simply weren't tracked. The other big shift has been in asylum applications. So a much larger percentage of people crossing the border are crossing and stating that they want to apply for asylum. Denial rates have been pretty steady, if not dropping somewhat. So despite claims that it's easy to come and get asylum, it is rather difficult. In particular, migrants from El Salvador and Guatemala, like Jacqueline and her family, who it appears didn't apply for asylum, have a very low rate of successfully applying for asylum. Okay, so getting back to Jacqueline's story, one of the ways that I try to think about this, or sort of one of the questions that I ask, is perhaps sort of a little of a brutal way of asking it, but maybe it's useful, is the following. Who killed Jacqueline? Perhaps another way of asking it is, why did she die? So on December 6th, 2018, Jacqueline and her father crossed the border into a remote area of New Mexico. They identified themselves to the Border Patrol. They were put in Customs and Border Protection detention. They were not separated. There is some dispute about to what extent Customs and Border Protection carried out a health evaluation of Jacqueline. Her father claimed that she was running a very high fever and that they delayed in providing her with medical attention. The proximate cause of her death, an autopsy showed, was a bacterial infection. Bacterial infection that caused dehydration and leading to organ failure. An infection probably exacerbated by the difficulties of a long, long process of trying to migrate all the way from Guatemala through Mexico to the U.S. border. This just poses another question. Why was she in custody? Here we have to think a little bit about two policies under the current administration, zero tolerance and family separation policies. And one of the things to point out is how these build upon, but dramatically sort of amplify, older policies. So let me talk a little bit about zero tolerance. Some of you might know this, but it's worth pointing out that crossing the border without authorization is a misdemeanor, right? It's like driving while intoxicated or littering or trespassing, right? Not to to minimize those things. It's a crime, a relatively minor crime. Crossing the border after having been deported, on the other hand, is a felony. Being in the United States without proper authorization is not a criminal offense. It is a civil offense. Right? So if you are in the United States without proper authorization, you can be apprehended, you can be deported, you will not be criminally prosecuted, found criminally responsible. Right? So from the start, we see how different ways of being in the United States are criminalized in different ways. So you can come with a student visa, a work visa, overstay your visa, and you're not criminalized the same way. Right? Previously, not all border crossers were detained and subject for prosecution. This started changing, and the Obama administration changed dramatically under the Trump policy, the so-called zero-tolerance policy. The typical pattern had been to detain as many border crossers as could be processed and housed, and then release others with a court date to appear to have their status determined. Since 2009, congressional appropriations bills have included laws that have mandated that the Department of Homeland Security must maintain a certain number, minimum number, of people in immigration detention facilities, right? They talk about it as detention beds, right? These are people occupying beds in immigrant detention facilities. That number has usually been about the minimum number of about 34,000 people who have to be in a minimum number in immigrant detention facilities. These detention facilities are largely run by private contractors who give a lot of money to politicians, so you can see how that operates, right? The typical pattern, when Customs and Border Protection detained someone, they often asked that person if they agreed to be returned to Mexico. In that case, they often immediately returned them. Starting in 2009-2010, the Obama administration started a policy called lateral deportation that took people and deported them not to the part of Mexico closest to where they crossed, but to other regions in Mexico. The idea was that this was going to deter people from simply trying to cross again. But in general, if the number of people that the system could hold, that minimum number had been met, if the number had that the system could process had been exceeded, people were issued a citation and then released. This was the so-called catch-and-release policy that we hear a lot about. Families who crossed tended to not be held in detention. People who arrived and made claims of asylum were sometimes held in detention for different periods of time, sometimes released. All these people are now being detained at much higher rates. To understand the family separation policy, we need to understand a prior set of legal policies, legal rulings, especially the Reno versus Flores decision. In 1985, Jenny Flores, a 15-year-old Salvadoran girl, crossed the border unaccompanied. Was detained by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the precursor to ICE. She was held in immigrant detention facilities with adults. She was strip-searched. She was, by all extents, subjected to some pretty harsh conditions. She and a legal aid organization sued the American government, claiming violation of due process and equal protection, right? That the government wasn't adequately protecting her and that they didn't really have grounds to hold her in this facility for that long. In 1993, the Supreme Court held that INS, the precursor to ICE, their immigrant detention policies don't violate the Constitution, but sent the case back to a lower court. And then the case was settled in an agreement. This agreement holds that minors should not spend more than 20 days in detention. So what had tended to happen when families with minors showed up because of the Flores decision. They tended to be released with a date to appear in court to have their status adjudicated. What's happened now, the Trump administration has decided to criminally prosecute everyone who's crossed the border. And they claim that because of that, families cannot be held together because of the Flores decision. Children have to be separated, right? In theory, children who cross unaccompanied or were separated from their families are supposed to be held for a minimal amount of time in Customs and Border Protection facilities, then transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, headed by the Department of Health and Human Services, who then are supposed to place them with a relative in the United States. This process is now broken down at all of those different stages. The other big change that's happened is changes in asylum policies in a couple of different ways. As I mentioned, a lot more people now are being held for long periods of time in detention while they're applying for asylum. The current Attorney General Barr has removed the option of being bonded while waiting for an asylum hearing. So the process should typically happen when people cross the border, they identify themselves to a customs and border agent, they ask to apply for asylum. They're supposed to then have what's called a credible fear hearing. They're supposed to have 48 hours, then have a hearing with an asylum officer who determines whether or not they have a credible fear if they are returned to their country of origin. This is just sort of the first point. If that person passes the credible fear hearing, they then have a full court hearing to determine whether or not they qualify for asylum. That can take several years at least, and the rates of people successfully getting asylum, especially from Central America, are really relatively low. The Trump administration claims that very few people turn up for their asylum hearings. Actually, the rates of people turning up for asylum hearings are pretty high. It used to be that if people passed a credible fear hearing, they could then apply, they could pay for a bond and essentially wait in liberty in the United States for their asylum hearing. Attorney General Barr has removed that, so people have to remain in detention while they're waiting perhaps several years for their asylum hearing to be heard. Prior to that, Attorney General Jeff Sessions altered the criteria that qualify for asylum so that fear of gang-related violence or fear of being victim of domestic violence generally did not qualify as criteria for asylum, right? So it's part of the bigger picture. I think the next question to ask, and again, Jenny Jacqueline came with her father, was not separated from her father. It appears that they were not requesting political asylum. So the next question to ask is, why did she and her father leave Guatemala? Central American migrants are coming for a variety of different reasons, a mixture of different reasons, often interlinked reasons. They're often fleeing from poverty. They're, in some cases, trying to escape political instability, especially in Honduras, which had a coup several years ago, has had a hotly contested series of elections. In Nicaragua, where there's been extensive campaigning against the Daniel Ortega presidency. In some cases, they're fleeing from other forms of violence. That's going to be political violence, violence by criminal gangs, or domestic violence. Jacqueline and her family, it appears, were fleeing poverty. In order to understand the roots of that poverty, I want to shift to the second picture here. And if you want to know a little bit more about this, Greg Grandin and Elizabeth Oglesby, two historians of Guatemala, have written quite a bit about this. When I heard that Jacqueline had died, it took me a minute or two to make the connections. Then when I heard her last name and where she was from, the connections to me seem rather obvious. So Jacqueline is from Alta Verapaz, Guatemala. She's from the area in Guatemala where in 1978 there was a rather infamous massacre. Jacqueline is Quechi Maya, like the at least 53 Quechi Maya who were killed in the Panzos massacre in Alta Verapaz. Beyond just that connection, Jacqueline's last name is Makin, which is apparently a fairly common last name for Quechi Maya. It sounded off signal bells to me because one of the people who was killed in the Panzos massacre in 1978 was a community activist named Mama Makin, Mother Makin, maybe a distant relative of Jacqueline's. Mama Makin, this distant relative of Jacqueline's, was part of a group of Quechi Maya who had actually migrated to this area from the highland areas of Guatemala where the Maya have historically lived. They got pushed out of the highland parts of Guatemala because of land concentration, very little land to farm to live on. They got pushed out of the highland areas of Guatemala also because of conflict that happened there in the 1960s. And they occupied this area, lowland area of Alta Verapaz, where they became engaged in a land conflict with people who claimed to own the land in that part of Alta Verapaz, a lot of whom were connected to the Guatemalan military and the Guatemalan establishment. It seems that on that day, in May 29th, Mama Makin, the other Quechi Maya, had gathered in the town square of Panzos they had thought that maybe they could pressure the local authorities to grant them land, title to land that they were occupying. It seems that the military opened fire on this group of people. We still don't know exactly how many people died. Somewhat after the massacre, and this photo actually is of the reinterment of people whose bodies were discovered quite a bit after the massacre. It seems that 38 or so bodies were discovered in the vicinity. Other people claim 53 people were killed in total. Some other people say that if you take not just that day, but the preceding days of violence, the several days of violence afterwards, and people who died from other related reasons, the number of people is perhaps 100 or more. Mama Makin, apparently, was a local organizer, apparently died as she was shielding her granddaughter from bullet fire. Her granddaughter, Maria Makin, has gone on to be a pretty important community activist. The Panzos massacre was, in some cases, rather unique. It was before the period of much more extensive violence that I'll talk about in a second. It was relatively disconnected from guerrilla insurgencies. It seemed to have a lot more to do with local conflicts. But it also set a larger pattern that came to characterize the next 5 or 6 years at least. The massacre was the product of mobilization that had been happening in the 1970s in a very intense way in Maya highland villages, where Catholic lay activists and a peasant organization called the CUC, the Committee for the Unity of Campesinos, had been mobilizing people to demand land rights, to demand better working conditions, as was the case in Panzos. A lot of this mobilization was met with violence on the part of the military, which had several different effects. Displaced people from the places that they were living, either as they fled violence or as they were rounded up by the military and relocated. Caused quite a bit of harm and also dramatically radicalized the situation. So the type of violence that happened in 1978 led to the reemergence of guerrilla mobilization in Guatemala in the 1970s. Several different guerrilla organizations emerge. And the military really uses the pattern that it had come up with in Panzos as a response It targets Maya indigenous communities, the Kekchi Maya, also a couple of other Maya indigenous groups. There are 20-some different Maya indigenous groups in Guatemala. The Ixchel and the Quiché Maya are identified as opponents of the military regime based on their ethnicity. These people are targeted for extreme forms of violence. The army, especially in from 1978 to 1983, engages in a scorched earth campaign, especially under Presidents Lucas Garcia and Rios Montt. This comes to get quite a bit of support from the United States. So on the timeline, I noted in 1979, there's a revolution in Nicaragua. The left-wing Sandinistas come to power. The U.S. had already been aiding the militaries in El Salvador and Guatemala, dramatically ramps up the aid to El Salvador, a little bit later ramps up aid to Guatemala. In order to fight against the Sandinista-led government in Honduras, the CIA also uses Honduras as a base for the anti-Sandinista counter-revolutionaries, the Contras, right? So in the Scorched Earth campaign, perhaps 300,000 people die, overwhelmingly civilians, perhaps 83% of them ethnic Maya. In some cases, these people were targeted because the military felt that they were supporting the guerrilla. Accusations of supporting the guerrilla could also be used for all sorts of other purposes that were much less clearly linked to actual conflict. So, for example, and I went with a group of students to visit this site in 2013, on March 12, 1982, in the town of Rio Negro, not too far away from Alta Verapaz, just sort of up in the mountains a little bit more, the army and civil patrollers massacred 177 Maya Achi women and children at the town of Rio Negro. In this case, these people were killed because they had been organizing opposition to a dam that the World Bank was funding, and also had come into conflict with neighboring villagers, some of whom were probably going to benefit from working on the dam. So accusations of involvement with a guerrilla were very elastic accusations that got labeled at a whole bunch of different people in different ways. So in a lot of ways, we can think of Jacqueline Maquin's parents and grandparents as survivors of this period that the UN Truth Commission came to see as a genocide. And as we know, trauma gets transmitted intergenerationally in a whole bunch of complicated ways. The war in El Salvador in Guatemala ends in 1996 through peace talks. Unfortunately, this meant relatively little for Jacqueline's grandparents and parents. Relatively little for the impoverished Maya. The peace negotiations were really negotiations of an overwhelmingly victorious Guatemalan military against a pretty much defeated guerrilla organization in Guatemala, a little bit different in El Salvador. This meant that some of the underlying causes of the civil war were never addressed. In particular, land distribution was never addressed. In Jacqueline's part of Guatemala, land that Maya villagers had been living on came to be valuable in a whole bunch of new ways. And this is what's been happening since the 1990s. This land has been valued for mineral deposits. In the case of Alta Verapaz, where Jacqueline's family lived, land also got put into production for African palm oil that's become a really important commodity, biofuel and other things. And it's resulted in a bunch of population displacement, too. So Jacqueline Kyle McKean's family, in fact, moved to where they're from another part where they had been displaced because of African palm cultivations in the 1990s, right? So all of this led Jacqueline and her father to feel like they had very few options, rather, other than migrating to the United States, right? I wish I had a nice, easy way of wrapping up this story. I don't think I do. I think when we ask who killed Jacqueline, when I ask that, when we think about our ancient twisted karma, when we think about how to think about responsibility for forms of suffering, I think on the one hand, it's important to use, you know, that mind that insists on certain distinctions and sees policymakers deliberately making policies, deliberately intending to harm people, that sees institutions that are failing because their leaders are inept or unable to make their institutions function. But I think also once we start expanding our thinking outwards, those circles of responsibility grow and get more complex and deepen and draw a lot of us into them, make a lot of us, make me think about ways in which we're all, in different ways, at different levels, also bound up in the lives of people like Jacqueline and in the deaths of people like Jacqueline, too. So I know this is a long, complicated story. Maybe I'll leave it at that and see if you have questions. The ongoing question for me is thinking about what are the Buddhist ways of responding, the Buddhist ways of understanding and thinking about this. Maybe there's, I don't think there is just one, but maybe what are some of the ways in which this can be thought about and understood and reacted and responded to?
This is the time when we can ask questions, start conversation, whatever comes up for people.
Two things about that. First of all, we are going to be on Saturday. We'll be at the southwest corner of Daly Plaza on Washington and Clark Street. That's where we're going to meet. We'll get to an hour to get there earlier, and we're going to set up the class at an area. And we're just going to sit. So you're welcome to join us. I'm going to bring some camping hats, so we won't sit on cold stone, at least the first few people who show up. And so you're welcome to join us for that. And the rally starts at 11, but we'll try to get there early. But look for us on the southwest corner of the plaza, right, Washington Park. One comment I would like to make, I don't remember the program, but it was on WBEZ about a week ago, and they had a very interesting program about United Fruit Company. And United Fruit Company played havoc with the whole Central America and just took over and basically made what they call where banana republics come from. Before it was clothing, it was coming in with money and making corrupt politicians and pushing everybody off the land just so they could grow bananas, which are the fourth largest crop, monetarily wise, after rice, wheat, and corn. And so it's big money. And it was interesting to listen to this program. I suggest that you have a chance to go into WBEZ's archives and listen to the program. And don't buy any cheap bananas.
Yeah,
one small thing you could do.
I decided to not go that far back, but there's a very, 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 very direct connection. The United Fruit Company owned had pretty extensive land holdings in Guatemala, and I put on the timeline. In the 1940s and 1950s, Guatemala has this period of peaceful democracy, and a man named Jacobo Arbenz gets elected president. Arbenz is very much a modernizer. He identifies both the agricultural elite and rural indigenous villages as what he saw as sort of hampering modernization, right? He wanted to integrate indigenous villagers into the modern economy, help them with a situation of dire poverty, but so that they could become consumers and producers, right? And felt that the agrarian structure was a problem, that there was a lot of unused land in Guatemala, right? So among the things that he started doing was a land reform project, a land redistribution project, right? And So the government would purchase parcels of unused land and reimburse the owners for the value of their land. And they decided that they would reimburse them based on the value of the land that the owners had declared for their taxes. Which is kind of a, you know, a big, yeah, middle finger up the, right? And the United Fruit Company and a lot of Guatemalan elite were very displeased about this. Two major shareholders in the United Fruit Company at that time happened to also be the director of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Secretary of State, the Dulles brothers, who had both previously just helped engineer the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. And they were very deeply and intimately involved in the overthrow of the democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz. That brought agrarian reform to a screeching halt in Guatemala and spurred an early wave of guerrilla mobilization in the 1960s. So the connection is deep and profound and immediate. Yeah.
Thank you, Ben. I mean, that was incredibly interesting and really distressing. You know, it's really helpful to get some of these things that we have, like, just vague notions about, really kind of, like, specified and clarified to sort of appreciate the tangled history. You know, in terms of, you know, what is a huge question, right? All the time. What is our response? And you know, the sort of catchphrase of a lot of engaged Buddhism to think specifically in those terms is simply, you know, the sort of injunction to not turn away. In other words, not pretend it's not happening, not ignore it, and then take the further step of realizing, sort of tracing out to the extent we can precisely what is our own involvement in that. And that seems to point to me, in a way, you know, to point directly to our involvement as citizens of the United States. You know, and you spoke about you know, holding inept and corrupt government institutions accountable. You know, and I think that's, you know, at least partly the intent, for example, of this rally, kind of witnessing, and you know, who knows? I think another, you know, Dave talked about, you know, you don't want to buy chiquita bananas. You know, those kinds of things. You know, we have the history in this country of great boycott in the late 60s. It had, you know, huge positive impacts ultimately. But it raises a more general question, you know, largely as, you know, at the level of us sitting in this room, our involvement in these things, you know, is as consumers, you know, and because we're consumers, you know, I don't know exactly the history and, you know, the market flows, for example, the palm oil you were talking about. It would surprise me very, very much if there weren't very, very strong interests in this country helping support that and encouraging that and, you know, keeping that going. And so, you know, I mean, how effective it is, I don't know, and it's something I despair of. But, you know, it seems like minimally as Buddhists and even more broadly as citizens, you know, we're called upon to make ourselves aware of these things and not pretend like it's all happening just because, you know, the ruling classes in Guatemala or elsewhere, you know, are large number of them happen to be, you know, particularly bad people. It's probably true that some of them are particularly bad people, but you know, that's fostered, supported by this, as you said, this really deep and complicated set of relationships that don't leave us out.
I think there's this history that's been systematically forgotten. Yeah. I mean, it seems, I feel so old, back in the 1980s. Yeah. But I think, we like systematically forget, ignore, minimize it, and don't think about those connections. I mean, I had this shocking experience at one of my very favorite coffee places that I won't name, because I think they're really well-meaning people, and I think that they would be equally shocked. I was buying coffee, and they had single-origin coffee beans from Guatemala, and there was one from a particular finca in Guatemala, and I was like, oh my gosh, really, that place? Which is a place where the EGP guerrilla showed up in 1982, summoned the landowner to the middle of the town, executed the landowner because he'd been involved in a long-running conflict with local villagers. And then the military showed up at that coffee finca and slaughtered hundreds of people over the course of several days and occupied the coffee finca. And there was coffee from that coffee plantation at my favorite coffee place. And I'm sure it's a complicated story. I'm sure that plantation has changed hands several times. But there are all these forces that encourage us to not think about those connections, to not remember that history, to not think about the way in which our lives are entangled. I suppose the other thing to point out, too, and that didn't come across maybe quite so much in this talk, is the deep history of mobilization that's been happening around these issues for a very, 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 very long time. Right? So I mentioned that a lot of people crossed the border in the 1980s fleeing conflict in El Salvador and Guatemala. A lot of them probably unaccompanied minors, too, a lot of families. Those people, when they crossed the border, were often completely unsuccessful in applying for political refugee status because they were fleeing violence connected to governments that the United States was supporting, right? So faith-based organizations in the United States, some of them in Chicago, engaged in a massive campaign of housing people in churches, defying deportation orders, and pushing very hard to get a limited kind of protection for refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala, temporary protected status. I mean, that came from faith-based organizations, grassroots mobilizing, right? And countless forms of mobilization in these countries, mobilization that's been happening in immigration detention facilities by detained immigrants. And so there's a whole other counter story of mobilization. It's a story of hope in a lot of ways that should be also pointed to.
I mean, I just wanted to ask then, on that, like, if you have recommendations for, two or three, four, like, organizations doing work down in the border region that, that you would recommend supporting if people are so inclined.
I would encourage support for a bunch of organizations working here in Chicago. I mean, if the border area, sure, absolutely. There's an interfaith committee for imprisoned immigrants here in Chicago that's been doing a lot of work with people facing deportation, has been holding vigils at some of the immigration detention facilities in the Chicago area. There are countless organizations that are mobilizing people at the neighborhood level in Chicago in anticipation of what might be large-scale immigration raids in Chicago. A bunch of fantastic grassroots work done by organizing communities against deportation. The Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights is another absolutely fantastic organization. And doing things like holding, we had a bunch of them at Loyola for, we have a substantial undocumented immigrant student population at Loyola, and they have parents and relatives, a lot of them who are undocumented if they're not themselves, and having Know Your Rights workshops so that people know what to do if Immigrations and Customs shows up knocking on the door. If Immigrations and Customs takes someone into detention so that they know how to track where that person is, how to try to help get that person some kind of legal assistance too. So at the border, absolutely, but there's so much important work being done and done courageously here in Chicago.
Can you list those somehow? Put those on the website?
For sure, yeah. Rogers Park has done this fantastic. There is this grassroots organizing going on in Rogers Park at the neighborhood level to make people aware of their rights and to think about how to respond should there be ICE raids, which happened in the city of Chicago. The fact that Chicago is a sanctuary city only means, and Mayor Lightfoot has expanded this, only means that the Chicago PD do not participate with ICE in immigration raids, that the Chicago PD does not hand over information in most cases about people who they have detained. It does not mean that ICE raids do not happen in Chicago. They happen all the time. Yeah? And that's, you know, the Four Noble Truths, right? We live in this world of suffering. There are causes to suffering. Greed, hatred, and delusion are patterns that we replicate, and we have to think about how we can identify them and work with them, right? And they're seductive, and it's easy to slide into that. There are all kinds of institutions set up to encourage us to slide into that. Identifying them, thinking about them, thinking about how we participate in them takes work, yeah.
So I wanted to, I know we are, I think, at the point of our sort of end of our conversation. I just wanted to thank you so much for speaking. Because I kind of know intellectually that this is a very complex situation, and I illuminated a lot of things, including sort of our own individual complicity as well as our government's complicity, and all the ways in which we, you know, need to educate ourselves, because even some of these connections, they jumped out for you, but that's because this is your specialty area,
right.
And it's certainly not my specialty area, and so that's why it's important, I think, for people who have knowledge about these issues to be able to speak out, and with the knowledge that we have, to be able to find ways to talk with other people, so that this is more well understood. You know, because I think one of the hindrances that we come up against is right there in the Metta Sutta. You know, we hold on to these fixed and limited views, and so I appreciate just learning more about all the different interconnections of all these issues and things we can do, but then things that have been going on, you know, long before some of us entered this culture. I think it's so vast that it reminds me of our inconceivable Bodhisattva vows, which we are about to chant. But